A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the freelancer who's already crossed the finish line. The one with steady clients, reliable income, the whole setup. And the question is, now what? Once you've built the thing, once you're actually making a living on your own terms, how do you know if you're still growing? Or if you're just getting really efficient at doing the same three things over and over?
This is the question nobody asks at the freelancer conference. Everyone's there to learn how to get clients, how to price, how to scale. Nobody's running the workshop called, I'm 4 years in, making good money, and secretly worried I'm becoming obsolete.
4 years in, $120,000 a year, same three clients, same three service lines. On paper, Alex has won. No boss, no commute, picks the kids up from school whenever. But Alex has this nagging feeling, and it shows up at 2 in the morning, that the last genuinely new thing they learned was in year 2.
Here's why this isn't just Alex's existential crisis. It's June 2026. Over the past 18 months, AI tools have been systematically commoditizing the middle tier of professional skills. Writing, basic coding, design, data analysis, the stuff a lot of freelancers built their practices on. If you're coasting on repeat work, you're not standing still. You're moving backward while the market moves forward.
The scary part is that the income doesn't necessarily warn you. You can be making the same money, or even more, because you've gotten faster, while the floor underneath you is getting thinner.
That's the tension we're going to unpack today. Why the very thing that makes freelancing sustainable can also make it stagnant, and what you do about it when you're the only person in charge of your own growth.
Because here's the thing Daniel's really getting at. In a company, someone else worries about your career ladder. There's HR, a manager, a performance review process. However broken, they exist. When you're a solo consultant, you're the CEO, the head of product, and the sole individual contributor of your own professional development. And there's no promotion track. There's just you, and whether you decide to push.
The paradox is that freelance work should be the best possible environment for growth. You get exposure to different organizations, different problems, different industries. In theory, you're learning more than anyone sitting in the same company for 5 years. But the exposure only works if you're deliberate about turning it into depth, and the economic incentives push you in exactly the opposite direction.
Let's name the elephant. Getting to full-time freelance income is hard. It's a gargantuan achievement, Daniel's phrase, and he's right. Most people who try don't make it. So when you finally get there, the instinct is to protect what you've built, not to risk it on growth. You've got a mortgage, a rhythm, clients who pay on time. Why would you mess with that?
That's where the perverse incentive kicks in. The work that got you stable is usually repeatable work. The same kind of project, the same deliverable, the same skills you've already mastered. Every hour you spend learning something new is an hour you're not billing. The opportunity cost is immediate and painful, so the rational economic choice, in the short term, is to keep doing what you're already good at.
Which is how you wake up 4 years later and realize you've done the same project 48 times.
There are two opposing forces here. Freelance work can accelerate your growth faster than any corporate role. You're seeing how different organizations solve problems. You're exposed to cutting-edge tools across multiple domains. But that same work can trap you in what I'd call a competency cul-de-sac. You're paid well for what you already know, and there's zero structural incentive to learn what you don't.
Competency cul-de-sac. I'm going to sit with that one.
It's the suburban subdivision of career development. Nice houses, well-maintained lawns, and you drive the same loop every single day.
The cul-de-sac is especially dangerous right now because AI is paving over the shallow end of almost every domain. The kind of work that's predictable and repeatable, exactly what a stable freelancer gravitates toward, is also the kind of work that's easiest to automate.
There's a stat from Upwork's 2025 Freelance Forward report that should keep every solo operator up at night. 47% of full-time freelancers reported no formal skill development in the past 12 months. These are people whose entire livelihood depends on what they know and what they can do, and half of them haven't done anything structured to expand that.
I bet a significant portion of that 47% would say, "I learn on the job," if you ask them. Which sounds reasonable until you ask the follow-up. What did you learn last month that you couldn't do the month before?
That's where it gets uncomfortable, because learning on the job for an established freelancer usually means getting more efficient at things you already know, not acquiring new capabilities. It's optimization, not growth.
Let's get into the mechanics of how this stagnation actually happens, because it's not just about being lazy. There's a structural trap here that even motivated, hardworking people fall into.
I want to start with what I think of as the skill atrophy spiral. You find a profitable niche, say WordPress maintenance retainers or basic SEO audits or template-based web design. The work is steady, the clients are happy, the money is good. The economic incentive is to optimize delivery speed. Get faster at the thing. Because if you can do in 15 hours what used to take 25, you've just increased your effective hourly rate without raising prices.
Which feels like winning.
In the short term, it is. But each year of that optimization deepens the rut. You're not learning new platforms, new approaches, new adjacent skills. You're just getting more efficient at the old ones. Meanwhile, the market is moving. New tools emerge, client expectations shift, and the value of what you do slowly erodes.
There's a concrete example happening right now. Think about a freelance copywriter who specialized in long-form B2B blog posts. In 2023, they could charge $1,500 a post. Good money, steady demand, build a whole practice around it. By early 2026, AI-generated drafts have completely compressed that market. The same client now pays $400 for a heavily edited AI draft. The writer never learned content strategy, conversion copywriting, or SEO analytics. Not because they were lazy, but because the blog post work was too profitable to leave.
That's a 73% rate compression in roughly 2 years. And the writer didn't see it coming because the client relationships were still there, the work was still flowing. The market shifted underneath them while the invoices still looked healthy.
Until they didn't.
Now contrast that with a freelance graphic designer I've been tracking. In 2024, they made a deliberate pivot from execution, making logos, designing marketing collateral, to strategy, brand architecture, design systems, the thinking work that sits above the making. They used client projects as paid learning opportunities, took a couple of projects at a slightly lower margin to build the strategy muscle, then productized that knowledge. Their rate went from $75 an hour to $200, while their competitors who stayed in pure execution saw rates drop 30%.
Same market forces, completely different outcome. The difference wasn't talent or work ethic. The difference was whether they treated their skill set as a fixed asset to be monetized or as a portfolio to be actively managed.
That brings us to the core structural problem. Traditional professional development frameworks, individual development plans, the 70-20-10 learning model, certification paths, all of these assume organizational infrastructure. They assume there's a manager to enforce the plan, a budget to pay for it, and protected time to do it. For a solo operator, none of that exists. Every hour spent learning is an hour not billing.
70-20-10, for anyone who hasn't sat through the corporate training, is the idea that 70% of learning comes from on-the-job experience, 20% from other people, 10% from formal education. It's a fine framework if your job naturally rotates you through new challenges. It falls apart when your on-the-job experience is the same job every month.
That's the curriculum designer problem. In a company, someone else figures out what you need to learn and serves it up to you. As a freelancer, you have to do 4 things simultaneously. 1. Identify what skills will actually be valuable in 18 months. 2. Design a learning plan to acquire those skills. 3. Execute that plan while still running your business. And 4. Find ways to apply the new skills before you forget them. Those are 4 distinct meta skills, and most people never develop any of them.
Because nobody taught them. Nobody teaches how to be your own professional development strategist in school, or in the freelance courses, or anywhere really. You're supposed to just figure it out.
The just learn on the job advice that gets thrown around freelancer communities. It's well-intentioned, but it fails for exactly this reason. Learning on the job works when the job is varied and stretching. When the job is the same three deliverables every month, learning on the job just means refining what you already know.
There's also a misconception I want to call out. The assumption that if you're making good money, you must be growing. Income stability and skill growth are often inversely correlated in freelance work. The most profitable work is frequently the most repetitive. You get paid a premium for being reliable and fast at something specific, which is exactly the dynamic that discourages branching out.
That's the exposure paradox in a nutshell. Freelancers who work with multiple clients do get broader exposure than most employees. You're seeing inside different companies, different teams, different problems. But breadth without deliberate depth building leads to what I'd call mile-wide, inch-deep competence. You know a little about a lot, which feels like expertise until someone asks you to go deep on something, or until AI can handle the shallow end of all those domains.
Mile wide, inch deep is dangerous in a world where the shallow end is being automated.
This is why the problem is getting worse right now. The market is bifurcating. On one side, commodity execution work, the kind of thing you could describe in a prompt and get back in 30 seconds. On the other side, strategic thinking, deep expertise, and the ability to integrate across domains. The middle is getting hollowed out, and that middle is where a lot of established freelancers have been comfortably sitting.
If you're Alex, 4 years in, good income, same three things, the warning lights should be flashing. Not because you're doing anything wrong in the present, but because the present isn't going to last.
That's the thing about the gargantuan achievement trap. It resets your risk calculus completely. When you're starting out, you've got nothing to lose. You'll take the weird project, learn the unfamiliar tool, say yes to the client who's asking for something you've never done. But once there's a mortgage and a rhythm and a reputation, the cost of a misstep feels existential.
It's like adopting a feral cat. The first one, you don't know any better. The second one, you remember the scratches.
The freelancer who's made it becomes conservative not out of laziness, but out of self-preservation. Every hour spent on something unproven could have been an hour billing a known client at a known rate. The math is brutal and immediate.
The math doesn't care about 18 months from now. It only cares about this month's invoices. That's the structural disadvantage of being a solo operator. You don't have an R&D budget. You don't have a skunkworks team. You don't have protected time that someone else is paying for.
Which raises the question Daniel's really driving at. What does professional growth even mean when there's no ladder? In a company, growth is legible. Junior to senior, senior to manager, manager to director. The path exists whether or not it's well maintained. But for a freelancer, growth is illegible. Nobody's going to give you a new title. Your clients don't care if you've leveled up, as long as the work gets done.
Growth becomes this private, almost invisible thing. You could be dramatically better than you were 2 years ago and have nothing to show for it except maybe slightly higher rates. And even that correlation is loose.
I think we have to redefine it. For a solo consultant, professional growth isn't climbing a ladder. It's expanding your option space. It's having more kinds of problems you can solve for more kinds of clients with more defensible expertise. The metric isn't a title, it's the range and depth of work you're qualified to do.
Which makes it harder to track, harder to celebrate, and harder to motivate yourself toward. There's no promotion party for, I can now do three things I couldn't do last year.
This is why the problem is accelerating. The half-life of a given skill is shrinking. A WordPress developer in 2019 could ride that expertise for 5 years with minimal updating. In 2026, the same developer is watching AI site builders eat the bottom 80% of that market, while the remaining 20% demands full-stack capabilities they never needed before.
The competency cul-de-sac used to have a longer grace period. You could coast for a while before the market caught up. Now the market's got a jet engine.
There's also a psychological dimension here. When you're a freelancer, your identity gets tangled up with your skill set in a way that doesn't happen as much for employees. If you're a WordPress developer, and that's been your identity for 6 years, admitting that WordPress development alone isn't enough anymore. That feels like admitting you're obsolete. It's not just a business pivot, it's an identity crisis.
Identity crises don't pair well with quarterly revenue targets. So the natural response is to double down. Market yourself harder. Find more of the same clients. Optimize the delivery pipeline. all of which feels like action, but is actually just running faster on the same treadmill.
While the treadmill itself is sinking.
We've got this perfect storm, a structural incentive toward repetition, an immediate and painful opportunity cost for learning, no organizational infrastructure for development, shrinking skill half-lives, and an identity that's wrapped up in what you already know. And the only person who can solve any of this is you.
Which is why the rest of this conversation matters so much. Because the freelancers who figure this out, who build a system for growth that actually works without a boss or an HR department, they're not just surviving. They're thriving in exactly the ways the doom and gloom headlines say shouldn't be possible.
Let's talk about what that system looks like.
The first thing to understand about the skill atrophy spiral is that it's not a moral failing. It's an equilibrium. The market rewards you for being fast and reliable at a specific thing, so you optimize for that. Each optimization makes you slightly better at the thing and slightly worse at everything else.
Which works beautifully until the thing changes, or until someone builds an AI that can do the thing in 8 seconds.
That Upwork stat becomes alarming in this light. 47% with no formal skill development in a year, that's not a laziness problem. That's a structural incentive problem. The system is working exactly as designed. It's just that the design has a slow burn failure mode.
The exposure paradox is the sneaky part. Because freelancers do learn things. They learn about different client personalities, different project management styles, different industry quirks. That feels like growth. It is growth of a kind. But it's horizontal growth, not vertical.
You're accumulating surface area, not depth. And in a world where AI can handle the surface level stuff across almost any domain, surface area without depth is a liability. You're competing with a tool that has infinite breadth and zero fatigue.
The mile-wide, inch-deep freelancer is the one most exposed to AI commoditization. Because the AI doesn't need to be better than you at your best thing. It just needs to be good enough at the thing the client is willing to pay for.
Let me ground this in the corporate comparison, because it illuminates why traditional professional development frameworks fail so completely for solos. In a company, you have an individual development plan. Your manager sits down with you, identifies gaps, lines up training, allocates budget. The 70-20-10 model gives everyone a shared language. Certifications have clear paths, prerequisites, exam dates. All of this assumes someone else is holding the structure.
Paying for the time.
That's the killer. In a corporate environment, your learning hours are salaried. You're not losing income when you take a course. For a freelancer, every hour of learning is an hour you could have billed at your full rate. If you bill $100 an hour and you spend 20 hours learning a new framework, that's $2,000 of opportunity cost, real, tangible, shows up in your bank account.
Which is why the just learn on the job advice fails so hard for established freelancers. When you're new, every project is a learning project because you don't know anything yet. But once you're established, your clients are hiring you specifically because you already know the thing. They're not paying you to learn. They're paying you to execute.
If you're honest with them about the learning curve, you risk the relationship. Hey, I'd love to take on this project. I've never done this before, but I'll figure it out. Is a great pitch when you're hungry and cheap. It's a much harder pitch when you're charging premium rates.
The freelancer ends up in this bind. The only way to learn new things is to take on work you're not yet qualified for. But the only way to get that work is to already be qualified. It's a catch-22 with an invoice attached.
Which brings us to the curriculum designer problem, and I think this is the most underappreciated challenge in the whole conversation. In a company, the learning path is prescribed. Someone in L&D has mapped out what a junior developer needs to become a senior developer, what certifications are required, what courses to take. The employee just has to show up and execute.
The freelancer has to be the L&D department, the student, and the person who evaluates whether any of it worked, all at once.
Four distinct jobs. First, forecast what skills will actually matter in 18 months. Strategic foresight, a skill in itself that most people aren't trained in. Second, design a curriculum. What's the sequence? What are the prerequisites? Third, execute the plan while still running a business. And fourth, find ways to apply the new knowledge before the forgetting curve eats it, which means landing a project that uses the skill within weeks or months of learning it.
Most people fail at step one and never even get to step two. They don't know what they don't know about where their field is heading.
The people who do have good foresight often fail at step 4. They take the course, get the certification, and then go back to their same 3 clients and same 3 service lines, and 6 months later the new skill has atrophied because it was never applied.
This is why I keep coming back to that graphic designer example. They didn't just learn brand strategy in the abstract. They found a client project, at a lower rate, as a deliberate investment, that forced them to apply it immediately. The learning and the earning happened in the same engagement.
That's the learning as service model, and is the closest thing I've seen to a cheat code for this problem. For now, the point is that the curriculum designer problem is real, it's hard, and nobody teaches you how to do it. Most freelancers are running a business while also trying to be their own university, without a faculty, without a syllabus, and without a degree at the end that anyone else recognizes.
The degree is the client who pays you more. But that client doesn't show up the day you finish learning. There's a lag, and the lag is terrifying when you're watching your billable hours drop during the learning period.
That lag is what creates the survivorship bias Daniel's question is really probing at. The freelancers who survive long-term aren't the ones who avoided the learning curve. They're the ones who found a way to make the learning curve revenue neutral, or even revenue positive, instead of revenue negative.
If you're taking a pure loss on every hour of development, the math eventually catches up with you. You can only subsidize your own education for so long before the business starts to creak.
Which is why the copywriter who stayed in blog posts isn't a cautionary tale about laziness. It's a cautionary tale about a business model that had no built-in mechanism for evolution. The work was too profitable to leave, until suddenly it wasn't profitable at all. That's the growth tax. Every freelancer who takes learning seriously hits this wall. You need to invest time that could have been billable, and that investment shows up as a short-term income dip. The people who can't stomach that dip drop out of the growth cycle entirely. The people who survive long-term are disproportionately the ones who figured out how to make learning revenue, or better, revenue positive.
Which is where the Salesforce consultant comes in. Late 2024, she's got a solid practice. CRM implementations, workflow customization, the stuff she's done for years. But clients keep asking about AI integration. Can we plug some intelligence into this thing? She doesn't know the tools. She could say, not my area, and keep billing.
That's what most people do. It's the rational, short-term move.
Instead, she takes one client at a reduced rate, essentially says, I'll figure this out on your dime, and you get a discount for being the guinea pig. She learns the AI tools on that project, builds a methodology, documents what works. By mid-2025, she's not just doing CRM implementations anymore. She's selling an AI-enhanced CRM strategy offering. That new offering becomes 40% of her revenue.
That's the learning-as-service model in action. She didn't take a course and then hope to find clients. She didn't spend months in unpaid study. She found a client who had the problem she wanted to learn how to solve, discounted the rate to account for her learning curve, and turned the whole thing into a product. The growth cycle and the revenue cycle were the same cycle.
The discount was her tuition. But unlike most tuition, she had a paying client at the end of it, and a case study, and a methodology, and a new premium service line.
This is the mindset shift that separates the freelancers who stagnate from the ones who keep evolving. Professional development isn't a cost center, it's a product development pipeline. You're not taking time off to learn, you're building the next thing you're going to sell.
How do you operationalize that? Because find a client who'll let you learn is great advice, but it's not a system. You need something you can run quarter after quarter without relying on luck.
3 systems that actually work. The first is the client pipeline audit. Every quarter, pull your last 10 projects. For each one, ask 2 questions. What skills did this project use? And what skills do I wish I had that would have made this project better or faster or more valuable? The second question is the important one. It surfaces the gaps you're currently working around.
The gaps you're working around are the ones costing you money, because you're either spending extra time or leaving value on the table.
The second system is what I call the learning retainer. Dedicate 10% of your monthly revenue to a non-billable project that forces new skill acquisition, not a course, a project. Build a tool for yourself. Write a case study that requires research you haven't done. Take a certification that has a real deliverable attached. The key is that it has to produce something you can show a future client.
10% feels like a lot, until you do the math on what skill stagnation costs you over 3 years.
The third system is the Peer Accountability Pod. 3 to 5 freelancers in complementary but non-competing fields. Structured agenda: what skill did you work on this month? What market signal did you notice? What's your learning goal for next month? The social contract replaces the missing boss. And the 2025 Freelance Economy Report found that freelancers in structured peer groups report 3 times higher skill development satisfaction.
That's not marginal. That's the difference between a system that works and no system at all.
The reason it works is that it solves the curriculum designer problem through distributed intelligence. You don't have to forecast market shifts alone. 4 other people are watching their corners of the market and sharing what they see. The pod becomes your L&D department.
Which brings us to the bigger reframe. If there's no ladder, what do you replace it with?
The skill portfolio model. Treat your capabilities like an investment portfolio with quarterly rebalancing. Core skills. Your current income drivers, the things clients pay you for today. Growth skills. Emerging demand, 6 to 18 month horizon, the things that will become core. And hedge skills, adjacent domains that protect you against market shifts, things you don't plan to monetize directly but that make you more adaptable.
For a freelance product manager, core is roadmapping and stakeholder management. That's where the money comes from. Growth might be AI product management or data analytics certification. That's where the money will come from. And hedge is basic coding for prototyping or no-code tool expertise. Not the main act, but it keeps you dangerous.
The percentages shift. In a stable quarter, maybe 70% core, 20% growth, 10% hedge. If you're seeing market signals that your core is under threat, you rebalance. 40% core, 50% growth, 10% hedge. The point is that it's intentional. You're not just taking whatever work shows up and hoping it adds up to growth.
The quarterly review is what makes it real. Without it, the portfolio is just a list. With it, you're actually managing your own evolution.
Let's distill this into 3 things you can actually do this week, starting tomorrow. Not frameworks to ponder, not mindset, shifts to journal about, 3 actions.
I like actionable. The kind of thing where you finish the episode and you've got a task list, not just a new anxiety.
First one, the skill portfolio audit. This week, pull your last 6 months of revenue. Identify your top 5 income generating skills, the specific things clients pay you to do. Not marketing, but Google Ads campaign management or email funnel copywriting. For each one, rate it 1 to 5 on 3 dimensions. How much do you actually enjoy doing it? How defensible is it against AI commoditization? Meaning, could a tool do 80% of this in the next 2 years? And how much demand growth are you seeing in your market?
Anything scoring below 3 on defensibility or demand growth is a red flag. Not necessarily a drop everything red flag, but a this needs a plan red flag.
The enjoyment score matters too, because the skills that survive commoditization tend to be the ones you're willing to go deep on. If you hate it, and it's vulnerable, you've got a double problem.
Second actionable item, implement what I'd call the one client, one new skill rule. For every 3 repeat clients you take on, the comfortable, predictable, you already know how to do. This projects. Take one project that requires you to learn something you can't currently do.
Yes, that 4th project might come at a lower rate initially. Treat the discount as tuition. If you normally bill $5,000 for a project and you take one at $3,500 because there's a learning curve, that $1,500 gap isn't a loss. It's a tuition payment that comes with a real client, a real deliverable, and a real case study attached.
Most people spend more than $1,500 on courses that don't produce any of those things.
The 1-in-4 ratio is sustainable. It keeps 80% of your income stable while carving out 20% for growth. You're not betting the mortgage on it, but you're also not standing still.
Third one. Join or form a peer accountability pod. 3 to 5 freelancers, different but adjacent fields, so you're not competing for the same clients, but you understand each other's worlds. Structured agenda, not just complaining about clients over coffee.
3 questions every meeting. What skill did you work on this month? What market signal did you notice? Something a client said, a tool that emerged, a shift in demand. And what's your specific learning goal for next month?
The specificity is the whole game. I want to learn more about AI is not a goal. I'm going to build 1 working automation workflow using an LLM API by our next meeting is a goal.
the social contract does the work that a boss would do in a corporate setting. You said you'd do it in front of three peers. Next month, they're going to ask if you did it. That's accountability without hierarchy.
It's also intelligence sharing. Your pod is your early warning system. Someone in a related field notices a shift before it hits your inbox, and suddenly you've got 6 months of lead time you wouldn't have had alone.
The takeaway underneath all three of these is the real shift. Professional growth for freelancers isn't about finding more time. It's about redesigning your business model so that growth and revenue are aligned instead of opposed.
That's the thing that took me the longest to internalize. I kept trying to carve out learning time from the edges. Evenings, weekends, the mythical slow month that never comes. But the learning always lost to the billable work, because the billable work had a dollar sign attached, and the learning didn't.
The freelancers who make it past the 5-year mark aren't the ones with the most discipline. They're the ones who stopped treating learning as something that happens in the margins and started building it into the core operating model. The learning retainer, the 1-in-4 rule, the peer pod, these aren't productivity hacks, they're structural changes to how the business runs.
Because if growth and revenue are in opposition, growth loses every time. The invoice wins. It has to. You've got real expenses and real dependence. The only way out is to make growth revenue positive, or at minimum revenue neutral, so there's no trade-off to agonize over. Where does this leave us? I think there's a bigger structural shift happening. As AI keeps compressing the value of execution-level skills, the freelance market is going to bifurcate. On one side, strategic consultants who grow continuously. They're the ones doing the portfolio rebalancing, the learning-as-service model, the whole thing. On the other side, commodity workers who stagnate, competing on price against tools that get cheaper every quarter.
The uncomfortable question is where the cutoff point sits. It's not going to be a clean line between smart people and everyone else. Plenty of talented, hardworking freelancers are going to end up on the wrong side because they never built the growth infrastructure.
My bet is the dividing line isn't talent or even current income. It's whether you've got a system for noticing market shifts before they hit your invoices. The peer pod, the quarterly audit, the deliberate exposure to adjacent fields. Those are early warning systems. Without them, you don't know you're in trouble until the rates start dropping, and by then you're playing catch-up.
The next 2 or 3 years might produce something we haven't really seen before, freelance guilds. Not the medieval kind with the funny hats, structured peer organizations that provide exactly the professional development infrastructure solos currently lack. Shared curriculum design, group purchasing power for tools and training, accountability structures, even shared credentials that clients start to recognize.
It's already happening in pockets. Those peer pods we talked about. Scale that up, add some structure, and you've got something that looks less like a networking group and more like a professional association for people who don't have employers.
It makes sense. Companies exist partly because they solve coordination problems, including professional development. If millions of people are working outside companies, the coordination problem doesn't disappear. It just goes unsolved. Someone's going to build the solution, and the freelancers who join early will have a structural advantage.
The guild model also solves the credentialing problem. Right now, a freelancer's credentials are basically their portfolio and their reputation. But as AI makes portfolios harder to verify, did you design that, or did Midjourney? There's going to be demand for trusted third-party validation. A guild that vouches for its members' expertise could become valuable.
Speculative, but not crazy. We might be at the very beginning of a new institutional form for independent workers, and the people listening to this conversation are early enough to shape it rather than just join it.
All of that is the structural future. The emotional core of this, the thing I keep coming back to, is simpler. The hardest part of being your own boss isn't the financial uncertainty. It's that no one else cares whether you're growing.
That's it. That's the thing.
A boss, even a mediocre one, has some incentive to develop you. A client has zero. They want the deliverable. Whether you're learning anything along the way is entirely your problem. And that means you have to care enough. About yourself, about your future, about not waking up obsolete at 2 a.m. To build the system yourself, nobody's going to do it for you.
The freelancers who make it past year 5, past year 10, past year 20, they're not the ones who got lucky with a niche that never changed. Those niches don't exist anymore. They're the ones who decided their own growth was worth the same seriousness they give to client deadlines and quarterly taxes.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, botanist Ethel Darnley mistakenly classified a lichen specimen collected in the Simpson Desert as a new species of Xanthoparmelia. It was later corrected. The specimen wasn't a new species at all, just a severely dehydrated example of a common rock lichen that had been misidentified for nearly a decade.
Right.
A dehydrated rock lichen.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us your own prompts, email the show@myweirdprompts.com or find everything at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
Until then, check your portfolio. Not the financial one, the skill one.
The financial one probably needs checking too, but that's a different episode.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.